Hi, my name is Darcy Losell, and I'm a job coach and job developer facilitator with the Peer Pathways Project. We're psyching each other out, I can tell. I'm psyching you out, aren't I?
Right.
So let's start again. So let's talk
about... Oh, who's doing the interviewing now?
Let's talk.
Hello, I'm Beth Kesselman, and this is Smashing the Ceiling, a podcast on social hiring and a St. Stephen's Community House production. Thanks for joining us. St. Stephen's Community House acknowledges that our locations are situated upon traditional territories of the Wendat, Anishinaabeg Nation, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations, and the Métis Nation. The treaty that was signed for this particular parcel of land is collectively referred to as the Toronto Purchase and applies to lands east of Brown's Line to Woodbine Avenue and north towards Newmarket. St. Stephen's Community House is a guest, and we recognize the enduring presence of the Indigenous peoples on this land. Welcome back to our final episode of Smash the Ceiling. It's been a great year, and to wrap up today, we are very, very lucky to have my colleague, Darcy Losell, join us. Darcy was mentioned back in episode 8 by Lambrina and Patricia of West Neighborhood House. He'll be speaking on some of the challenges and successes of this pilot project. In a second conversation we're including today, we are fortunate to have Lisa Robinson back from Volunteer Toronto. Lisa joined us in episode 5 and talked about an ongoing research project. It turns out that Volunteer Toronto has completed the research and we're able to be among the first to hear its findings. So I hope you enjoy this episode and can geek out a little with us about research. So without further delay, I hope you enjoy these conversations.
So thank you so much for coming on our podcast, our final podcast. It's very exciting and you've been a part of this project since the beginning.
Yeah, we've been working together since June of 2017 on this project, and I've been sort of more engaged with working alongside the peers and the job seekers who we've brought onto the project. Peer Pathways, I mean, this project has been really exciting. We received some special funding from Service Canada, so this pilot project has been a chance for St. Stephen's to go deeper into its work with peers and individuals who identify with disability. And the goal was to give them pre-employment training, life skills training, support, coaching, and to help them find work in social services and in different positions where they could be a community support worker or a peer support worker. Mm-hmm. It's been really exciting to watch it grow over the year and see the individuals who were in it to sort of have their lives impacted.
Could you clarify a little bit of what a job coach is?
Right, so my role on this project has been to be a job coach and a job developer. I think a job coach is just a fancy name for someone who is there to support a seeker or an individual who is transitioning from being unemployed towards getting back into the labor market. And the coaching is, I like to use the sport analogy because you very much are, you're giving people tools, you're giving them resources, and you're encouraging them through positive interactions, informal counseling sessions. You're really trying to meet them where they're at and motivate them towards seeing their goals through, whether that be to work part-time or to be a volunteer or to do education and training. Right, so at the heart of this project, for me as a coach, I've been there to really facilitate their growth and development as professionals and try to assist them and move them in their goals, move them along.
So a lot of what you do is providing space for people to actualize their potential.
Correct, and in this project in particular, we've been doing all of this employment coaching or job coaching through a harm reduction lens. In other words, meeting these job seekers where they are at, encouraging them to follow their goals and, you know, based on what they want, not on what we're imposing on them, and just trying to create a space for them. And each individual, they all had really different needs, but I think the common theme that kept emerging was that they all wanted to give back to the community.
That's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. What would you say some of the broader goals of the project were, and do you think that those goals were achieved?
So some of the broader goals of this project were to create community partnerships with local organizations that also worked with peers or believed in the concept of peer work. The objectives too were to increase the employment capacity of the individuals. Most of them wanted to make some progress in getting work in social services or in the socials, the support field. The goals too with this podcast and talking more about social hiring, to just generally promote peer work and I guess in a way sort of be ambassadors and go to different agencies and work with different employers to increase their ability to hire individuals who identified with disability.
And do you have an example?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we have countless examples where the individuals we were supporting had clearly identified a disability or a challenge they were facing. And yet we were able to leverage the strengths and the knowledge and expertise they did have, the lived experience they had, to get roles in community-based services. So a great example of that is we helped one of our participants to get a role working as a peer support worker inside an emergency department of a major hospital in Toronto. Through our project and through the advocacy work we did, and we were able to help her get into a hospital job, which are highly coveted. We've done some great work with drop-in support and respite services in Toronto as well, and we were able to help some of our job seekers find peer support roles in these services. And again, these are services that are being used on a daily basis by the most vulnerable members of our city. So to see individuals who said at the beginning of the project, I want to give back, and then actually be in the front line of delivering really vital and important services has just been incredible to see.
And when you were talking to employers about somebody who you know, even though you can't disclose, is living with a disability, you know, what kind of responses were you getting from them after hire or during the hiring process?
So the responses have been varied, but overall, we've had the greatest impact with agencies that already understood the power of hiring individuals with disabilities or hiring peers or individuals with lived experience. So I've been amazed at the employers who have been open to it. All the conversations have been about the advantages of hiring through our project. I think what they were most attracted to is the idea of having the coaches there who would be helping the trainee or helping the job seeker during the placement period. And they were attracted to that idea that they could call us or get in touch with staff to get support during that process. So the responses have been overwhelmingly positive. I find most of the employers have been fantastic in regards to accommodation. That's where being a coach is such an integral role to play in these sorts of training opportunities or these employment opportunities, because you can help the participant negotiate an accommodation. And you know, just opening up the conversation with the employer or the supervisor, being there as a coach to offer the individual ideas on how to have that conversation, it's been great. Almost all the employers we've worked with have been really tolerant and understanding of the challenges that these new trainees have faced.
For a new hire, regardless of circumstance, negotiating an accommodation and at the beginning of an employment opportunity can be absolutely terrifying. So I can only imagine how much better it would be if they have a buddy in their corner for people who are experiencing a disability and have to have that potentially uncomfortable conversation with an employer, especially because you're dealing with their human rights and human rights accommodations. I feel that it was a really incredible service to provide. And you, having gone through it, did you find that a lot of your participants were happy to receive assistance, or did a lot of people just want to go it on their own and have that conversation?
It's interesting. I think in terms of the participants having conversations around accommodation or about disclosure, again, it's a very personal decision that a job seeker or an individual makes to decide whether to disclose or negotiate accommodation. It really it really varied case by case. And I would urge other career professionals that are working in this field to make sure that when they are working with an individual case, that they take their time to really talk with their participant about their comfort level. I would say it's about half and half. Half of the folks I've supported have wanted to just navigate the workplace on their own with very little of my involvement. But then there's been other cases where they've wanted me to be involved in every step of the way, every conversation, you know, the regular monitoring that we do where we go on site, they want me to be there. So it's been really, there's not been a lot of gray area. It's either been, you know, I want you as a coach to be there every step of the way, or hey coach, can you just sit back and let me do this? It's been rewarding to watch two different types of participant interactions, right? Some where I just stand back, and others where I'm really involved.
Did you have anyone who was like, I feel really confident, I'm going for it, and then go, oh wait, I have a question for you?
Yeah, I mean, there's an individual right now who's doing sort of a unique internship, and you know, once we sort of set up the training plan and got things underway, you know, they were initially wanted me to be really there from the day to day, but then I received a text kind of indicating that maybe I should just step back and coach, let me go for it. Let me just do my thing. And I've heard that a lot from some of the more confident job seekers, but there have been a few that will email me or text me and really want that advice in a crucial moment. So I think that's the thing you learn as a coach, is that you've got to be responsive and always keeping up with everyone.
What do you think are the main challenges when you're hiring someone with an invisible disability, and how do you overcome them?
I think the main challenges that you will see out there with employers hiring people with disabilities is just this notion of bias. I've been doing a lot of reading on this, and I think it's, everyone has bias. We are human beings. We judge, we assess. That's what I've faced the most, is just people's perceptions around disability, people's biases around disability. So the greatest challenge too is just when you are working in a social service agency like St. Stephen's, and you approach an employer or you approach a community contact, they sometimes wonder why. Why are you advocating on behalf of this individual? Why are you offering me all of these wonderful resources? What's wrong with this picture? So you'll find, because a lot of employers are risk averse, you'll immediately get some skepticism about why this charity. So what I've noticed is the greatest challenges is not the capacity of the candidate. It's not the participant that you are trying to help get an interview or get a meeting with the employer. It's this preconceived notion of why an agency would support a person with a disability. So it's actually the whole reason for why we're doing our work that they find challenging. Why do these people need your help? That's a lot of what I've experienced. So again, I think that boils down to people's preconceived notions about what do organizations like St. Stephen's do for people. It may also have something to do with the connotation of our name. Do they think we are a religiously affiliated organization? So the challenges are just in the sort of more selling an employer on the concept of the program than the actual act of getting them hired or getting them an interview.
So how did you overcome that?
Well, I think, again, the way we overcome this kind of challenge was just to explain the benefits to the employer of hiring a person with a disability. But we wouldn't even frame it that way. It was more about the benefits of hiring this individual person and the benefits of working with the coach team. So when you just talk about the benefits to partnering with an organization like St. Stephen's and doing a placement or a training experience, they immediately saw the potential because the coach is there to support. And I think that is what helped a lot of employers overcome their bias about hiring from an organization like ours, or hiring from under this notion of a placement.
And so having spoken to many employers and having worked with, you know, dozens of, you know, from the employer's perspective candidates, do you think now that anyone could hire a person with a disability?
Do I think that any employer could hire a person with a disability? Yes and no. I think I would say no if they don't have the capacity. In other words, they don't have dedicated staff or supervisors that can really be there to see this individual, onboard them, really give them a comprehensive orientation and training. So I wouldn't recommend this to employers if they don't have that type of infrastructure, if you will, in place to be able to really facilitate the onboarding process of a candidate or a person with a disability, because things might take a little bit longer. There might be some learning needs that need addressing. There are accommodation needs that might need addressing. So really it boils down to capacity. Does that employer have a work culture and a staff culture that could support that? But then again, the answer is also yes. I think most employers that are interested in hiring persons with visible or invisible disabilities, the one thing they need to think about is how can they support comprehensive training plans? I mean, that was one of the keys to the success I had this year, was collaborating with the employer to create a training plan that suited the candidate. And as long as that employer has the willingness to check in on a frequent basis, to support a training plan, taking the time to teach, to impart skills onto that participant, then yes, that employer definitely should hire individuals with disability. Because at the end of the day, we know what strengths they bring. The loyalty, the dedication, the focus to the tasks at hand. I mean, I'm sure you've done this on your podcast, talked about the many benefits of hiring individuals with disability.
And lower turnover, and yeah. I mean, statistically speaking, also, you've already hired someone with a disability. If you've got more than four people in your organization, statistically speaking, someone is living with a disability, whether it's known or unknown.
I really do believe as a coach, and this is why I love doing this work, is because when you find the right environment, almost any individual can really thrive. It's just about finding that right match and fit that's going to bring out the best in that individual.
And that employer.
And that's a really good point. We need to work as job developers and job coaches to also help employers recognize what their needs are and help them find the optimum fit for their needs, for their organizational needs. So that's part of the journey and part of what makes this kind of work so exciting.
So thank you so much for joining us on our final tier, our final podcast. It's been wonderful working with you over the last year, and hopefully sometime in the future we'll have the chance to collaborate again.
Yeah, well, thank you, and your podcast has been fantastic, and I hope that people go back and listen to different episodes, and hopefully we'll see Smash the Ceiling 2.0
hopefully
in the future.
Amazing. Yeah, awesome.
Well, thanks, it's been wonderful to be on the program today.
Darcy has been super busy lately, so thanks again, Darcy, for joining me on the podcast. It was great having you on. Since the Peer Pathways project is coming to a close, Darcy will be joining the St. Stephen's Employment and Training Center's team as a job developer in June. Next up, you'll be hearing a conversation with Lisa Robinson, where we get a super neat update on Volunteer Toronto's research project. You can tell I'm a bit geeky about it.
So thank you, Lisa, for joining us.
Thanks for having me back. I had so much fun last time. It was such a great conversation.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it too. So last time you were on our podcast, on Smash the Ceiling, you were talking about some research. If you'd like to just basically give a quick review of what you were doing, and I know you've completed your research now, and tell us a little bit about what you've learned and where you hope it's going next.
Totally. So I guess in September, I was hired at Volunteer Toronto to look into barriers to volunteering, essentially. And at Volunteer Toronto, we offer a range of services, one of which is the opportunity to be supported by a referral counselor, in learning more about volunteering in Toronto and how to access opportunities. We also provide organizational capacity building supports and these sorts of things for volunteer programs. So that's kind of what we do. The research came out of the observation that there's a lot of people in the city who are finding that there's barriers to volunteering, and someone, not me, I can't take credit for it as I say the other one, but someone saw that that there was an opportunity to do a better job of supporting people and organizations in minimizing barriers to volunteering, specifically in looking to leverage volunteering to increase employability as well for individuals. So that's the research I was doing. Since then, I have conducted 6 different focus groups, one of which with in partnership with St. Stephen's, which is pretty awesome. And then, you're welcome. Six different focus groups and 25 qualitative interviews. The focus groups were with individuals who have experienced barriers to either volunteering or employment to better understand what that lived experience is like and the impacts of that. And the qualitative interviews were with people who work in the volunteer management or inclusivity and accessibility sector, kind of to pick away at what other people are doing out there, because, you know, the social service sector and stuff, we're pretty siloed, so might as well see what other people are up to and see if you can build something from that as well.
So what were your findings?
Yeah, findings. So I guess if I had to sum it up, and some of this might seem obvious, but now we have like the proof, the tangible proof of it.
It went from theoretical,
yeah,
we think we know what's happening,
exactly,
to we now know what's
going
on.
We heard it from people who are experiencing it. So I would say that something that was confirmed that perhaps we suspected is that barriers exist. It's not just about the individual. It happens at an individual level, an organizational, and a systemic level. So knowing that, we need to consider, in kind of moving forward, we're considering like how do we tackle kind of all sides of it, or where is our impact in the individual, in the organizational, and in the systemic sort of realm. And then I guess the main thing on the individual side that came out of it is that you can really divide barriers that individuals face into kind of 2 main things. One is lack of knowledge, misconceptions about volunteering and what that looks like. And then there's also the access based side of it. So having access to the resources that you need in order to engage in the volunteering side of it.
What would that be? What's an example of a resource for volunteering?
So it could be something as simple as having access to internet and computer and being able to apply to that. It could also be having access to like opportunities in your community. I guess something that I talked a little bit about on the previous podcast is the Sustainable Livelihoods Framework. Still a big component of this. Basically, what that talks about, as well as the opportunity equation, actually. To sum it up once again, basically, it's the idea that access to opportunities, specifically of the economic variety, that minimize susceptibility to poverty and economic vulnerability, can be dictated by more than just financial resources. So you can access different opportunities through like social connections. You can do this, it's more of like an internal experience, but by having experiences that increase your self-confidence, so you're more willing to go out and access new opportunities. These sorts of things, as well as just those like hard and soft skills that we develop as we do new things, that can be seen as valuable. And so when we're talking about like access-based things that can help you to access volunteering, how many times can you say access? But actually, I joke, but access is really what it comes down to. Like, who has access to volunteering opportunities and who doesn't? And is that based on how you conceptualize volunteering based on the context that you might have grown up in if you're a newcomer to the city, which I think the stats are 48% of Torontonians are immigrants at this time, and for the first time ever, more than 50%, 51.5% of Torontonians identify as a visible minority.
Wow!
Yeah, so that's interesting in the access side of things. Check out the Vital Signs report. I feel like every time I come, I'm like, also this report just came out. I'm a researcher, folks.
And I appreciate that. Yeah.
So the Vital Signs report was put out by Toronto Foundation 2017. Has great stats on, it's like a temperature check on where Toronto's at right now, demographics, access-wise, all this sort of stuff. That's where those stats come from. Thank you, Toronto Foundation. So why does this matter? Why am I talking about this in the context of access? It's a good question. Follow my train of thought. But basically, what we know is that newcomers experience poverty at higher rates and exclusion from community at higher rates. We also know that people who are identify as visible minorities are at higher risk of poverty. Poverty is racialized. This is something that we know. So this matters because if we want to use volunteering to support those in getting opportunities who normally face significant barriers, then we need to focus on the vulnerable populations, like the newcomers and people who identify as being visible minorities. So that's like a very roundabout way of being like, access is really important. And when I say access to experiences in your community, what we know also is that different neighborhoods are becoming very defined by certain socioeconomic statuses and these sorts of things. If you are living in a community that has a lower socioeconomic status, the chances of you being exposed to more opportunities in volunteering, in economic participation, these sorts of things, minimize. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Also, do you want to know, have another interesting fact?
Of course.
But it's also a little bit like distressing, I think. The rates of people living in poverty in the neighborhoods of Toronto, in some neighborhoods, it will be as low as 1 in 30. In others, it'll be as high as 2 in 3 people living in poverty, which, like, just shows you that, like, poverty is localized. And so when we're thinking about this in relation to the research that we're doing, like, questions we need to ask ourselves are, like, how do we take the concept of volunteering to these neighborhoods where individuals who can really benefit from being more included in community and having more access to different types of social networks and these sorts of things can then, first of all, even have like access to this, like I said, and second of all, how can we support people to better leverage that, to use it to become more economically included or whatever their goal for volunteering might be.
Yeah.
So on the individual side of things, there's that. On the organizational side, I'd say that organizational barriers to including like volunteers who face who have trouble, who are less included or less often included. On the organizational side, organizational and systemic really kind of come together in a way, because it really is about this idea that in the nonprofit sector, we're dealing with a lot of project-based funding. There's not usually a defined volunteer coordinator or manager role. It's that plus whatever your other job is. And the reality is that creating a volunteer program that is inclusive and responsive to a variety of lived experiences in a way that makes it a safe place for people to be and contribute is costly in time. Also finances. Think about if you want to get all your documents translated. I just quoted it out and it's like starts at $60 an hour for document translation. So it really is like something that until it becomes a priority from funding, then it's always going to be secondary to whatever the like project is that needs to use volunteers. Does that make sense? The outcomes from the project versus the outcomes for the individual volunteer. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's always a basically it's always secondary, and that's systemic and not like to be pinned on any one organization, but it does impact organizations and their ability to integrate or to create a fully inclusive and safe volunteer program.
When you're looking at a volunteer program, it's very much, in my mind, because I come from a nature background, I think very much it's very recruiting-y. You have your pool of applicants, you're attracting a certain kind of pool of applicants that you think is going to be a good cultural match with your organization, and so you come at it from that point. So you're not usually gathering a pool of people that are very diverse. You're going after who you think is a good match.
Which often, like, who you think is a good match without a lot of, like, you know, critical self-analysis. Not critical in the sense that, like, you're bad at this, but just analyzing, like, what are my biases and stuff, often equates to people who would do it like I would, or people who have a similar, at least beginning, knowledge base to myself. So me, I'm white, like relatively educated, female, grew up in a smaller center, but still an urban center. And so I'm probably going to look for people more like me. And there's more people in the positions of recruiting who look like me and have my experience than those who have faced a lot more barriers than perhaps I have.
Mm-hmm.
So then we see this like perpetuation of people who already have a lot of visibility in the community being volunteers and gaining visibility and social contacts through that as well.
Yeah.
And then exclusion from these sorts of communities continues for visible minorities, newcomers, people who have ongoing mental illness, all these things that keep people from being able to participate in a quote-unquote, like, normal way in employment and community and these sorts of things.
Absolutely. And that's sort of, so when you come from a recruitment perspective, you're trying to find, quote-unquote, the best person for that role in your eyes, right? Which is why this project of the Peer Pathways Project was so important in this podcast and our like documentary-esque kind of things we've been doing is because social hiring, social volunteering, creating communities, that's not the perspective that's going to advance communities.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's really, so your research and our work have a very direct connection.
Yeah, they really do. And it was really clear in like conducting all of the focus groups and also the one that was in partnership with you guys, just like how consistent the themes were that people who face barriers expressed, I guess, as far as their experiences. And I'd say like something that really struck me is the biggest barrier we're up against from the individual perspective, I think, is actually the internalization of all these messages of exclusion and everything. And with the professionalization of volunteering, like you need your resume, all this stuff, as well as here are all the qualifications we're looking for in a volunteer. Like, if you've already had trouble navigating, like participating in an economic sense, then to then go and be like, I'm gonna give my time for free now. Wait a second, I have to go through the exact same process that made me feel so awful before. That is a really scary thing from like an emotionally distressing place too. There's, I think it might have actually been one of your colleagues, Darcy, when I spoke with them. He was the first person who introduced the idea of like application trauma and job trauma to me, and I think that's like a very real thing that came up in not so many words, but in different anecdotes in focus groups, is this idea of like, I've applied this many times, no one's gotten back to me, I can't hear no anymore, because I'm starting to integrate that to my self-concept, and this idea that like, I don't have the skills that someone wants, so why would I ever try and access volunteering, let alone try and apply for a job? And that can be like incredibly detrimental if we want to like look at it from a bigger picture. These feelings can contribute to social isolation, which has huge health repercussions in the long run, outside of all the other like bigger picture repercussions as well. Apparently, like I think they've said it's going to be the number one killer of our generation beyond, it's like stress and isolation, which previous generations, smoking, you know, like these things that we're just starting to tie to true health outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
as we digress once again.
Yeah, we have a tendency to do this.
Yeah.
Very good. So you've completed your research, you have your findings. What's next?
Oh, well, this is a really good question. So when I was talking about, like, we know that there's barriers at the individual, organizational, and systemic level, I think something that I've been really aware of, and don't worry, I'll answer your question in a second, is, like, what is the actual scope of impact that we have at Volunteer Toronto? Like, we have a mission, we have a vision, what can we do? And we've kind of come up with, like, two main answers. So on the individual level, knowing that it's these internalized experiences, knowledge and access based, right now we're looking at actually a bit of a peer model. Shout out to all the peer models. They're very effective. I actually was just listening to the West Neighborhood House where they talk, podcast, on
yes,
where they talk about why is it so effective and why is peer hiring a thing and these sorts of things. Anyway,
absolutely.
I listen to that one. Something that we're exploring right now I'm working with an advisory committee of 8 individuals who have experience of, like, barriers to volunteering or kind of work in that realm. We're exploring right now what would it look like to have a peer support person. So you come to Volunteer Toronto, you want to learn more about volunteering. You see one of our volunteer support people, our referral counselors, and they're like, oh, there's a lot more going on here for you than just, hey, here's 5 options, like, apply and good luck, you know, which works for most people, or for some people, but not for everyone. So what would it look like if a person walked in who might need extra support, if it were a referral counselor, then referred them on to a peer support person who would then navigate the whole process with them, try to normalize those feelings of being, like, excluded and be like, you know what, this isn't actually about you, this is about something bigger than you, and this isn't a reflection of who you are.
Yeah.
So just being that voice when there's already a pre-developed relationship, so it means more than just me walking up to someone and being like, hey, it's not just you, you know me.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. And also just someone who has experience navigating, like, okay, what does it look like when you want to apply for a volunteer role? What is this interview process going to be like? Yeah, it's normal that they are going to ask you for a police check for this particular role. A lot of organizations will provide funding. Like, you know, all those little things that you may not know about, to really just be by your side through that whole thing. So we're looking at what might that look like, and specifically trying to define, like, what can a peer support person do versus what is not within their role.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the place we're at right now. We actually had a meeting last night and kind of mapped out the volunteer journey and what barriers exist at each place, and then mapped on top of that, like, what could a peer support worker do to minimize or eliminate that barrier. So that was exciting. So that's what we're looking at from, like, the individual perspective.
Okay.
From the organizational perspective, how can we better support organizations who are also, a victim isn't the right word, but who are also dealing with the impacts of a system that isn't giving them what they need to provide people with what they need.
Yep.
So I talked on our last episode I was on about the youth audit program that
yes.
we have. Yeah, so quick recap. Basically, we have 3 different teams of youth who go into different organizations if they request it to figure out what's happening in their volunteer program and how that volunteer program could be adapted to better include youth.
Okay. Yep.
Make sense?
Yes.
So we have done a lot of research on that, a lot of program development on that, but we're looking to expand our volunteer audit program, and we'll keep the youth audit going, is the hope, and then we'll also have a newcomer-focused audit team, specifically just because we felt, long-term, we would love to have many different branches of audit teams with different lived experiences, but given our research and what's happening in Toronto with our changing demographics, we felt like the most compelling sort of next group, not to put groups in hierarchy, but for us that made the most sense. Also given who's walking through our door and accessing referral services as well. So that, from an organizational perspective, that's one part of it, and then hopefully developing some really targeted trainings as well for organizations on how to increase inclusive practices, like day-to-day, for volunteers who have faced other barriers and experienced a lot of marginalization at the hands of the system.
At the hands of the system.
Yeah. Right. So those are kind of our two big actionable things, or programs, I guess, that we're looking at. And I think what became very clear very quickly to me is, like, you can't support the organizations without supporting the individuals, and you can't support the individuals without supporting the organizations, because it really is a journey. And if you're not connecting those things, then really what you're doing is a little bit in vain on either side, because you're going to eventually hit a roadblock that you can't actually make much change in. Mm-hmm. So that was really important.
So you have a two-pronged approach.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Create the bridge over the barrier.
Oh, now it is.
Bridge over troubled water. Anyway, so that's where we're at. And it's really exciting for me to, like, have spent so much time, like, first of all, reading about this, then talking to people about it, and now being like, hey, we have some tangible ideas. And I'm here until September, so we still have some time.
Nice.
And that's definitely what we're working on from that side, and then the report as well, just so that we can be like really package, like, hey, here are all the things we found out, and recommendations.
Is your report out, or when is it?
No.
You're like, no.
No, not yet. It'll come out in August, I think, realistically.
Well, I definitely look forward to reading it when it comes out.
Me too. Also writing it.
Also writing it.
Yeah. So,
awesome.
Yeah. So that's
where we're at. That's awesome. Well, I'm going to thank you again, as always, now, because I can say that, because you've been on twice. And thank you. So thank you again for being on our final podcast.
Hey, it's an honor.
Oh, I really look forward to the report, and I thank you so much for I think Volunteer Toronto for taking this on, because it's something that's so informative for the volunteer sector, but also the human resources sector and Toronto as a whole. So I think we'll see the ripple effects for this project for a long time.
Fingers crossed.
Thank you, Lisa, for discussing your findings and coming back on Smash the Ceiling. It's been a joy chatting with you over this past year, and hopefully there are other opportunities for collaboration in the future. And believe it or not, that wraps up the final episode of Smash the Ceiling. Huh. So, in closing, thank you for joining us. It's been a wonderful journey this past year. It's been a privilege. And I just want to give one more huge thanks to all the organizations and all the people who collaborated with us by hiring a participant from the program, coming on the podcast, discussing research, connecting at information and career fairs or community events, or just plain chatting with us about employment. Most of all, thank you for having an open mind when it comes to your hiring practices. It's what makes doing this worthwhile. And if you have any continuing questions about hiring, I would suggest you connect with Darcy Lassell at ldarcy@sscho.ca. That's ldarcy@sscho.ca. Thanks for listening. St. Stephen's Community House would like to thank United Way, as well as the Ministry of Advanced Education and Skills Development and Employment Ontario, for their continued support with this project. We would also like to acknowledge Monk Turner for allowing us to use Judicious Jude for our music, as well as Satunium for the percussive loop.